What are the personal rewards that you have achieved or felt as a result of your work with the Moroccan Indians? What things have you benefited as a human being living and working with Indian people?
Well, I certainly have felt great benefits. Now, it may be a little hard to articulate them, but I don't know they're tremendously unique, because there's a growing awareness of our dependency on the resources of this planet, and that they're not inexhaustible, and that we're exhausting them very rapidly, and that the Indians had a way of life that fitted in with harmoniously with a cycle of existence, and did not defile and use up the non-renewable resources, not because they were superior human beings or had greater insights. It was just the way it was with a small population and living by their technology. But still, it sets us an ideal that we know that we're despoiling and we have to change our ways. I had a train of thought that I'd lost. Their feeling of harmony with nature, I think, should be part of our religion. It's just part of our economy. We're beginning to get around, wise up to the fact that we can't live at the level we are living now without... it just is not a lifestyle that can be continuous in millennia. Of course, a lot of people aren't thinking of millennia. They're thinking that the nuclear holocaust will come and we might as well live it up. I think that's what James Watt felt, that he was born again and he was probably one of the saved and he was going to go to heaven, and so it didn't matter much what was left behind. And we might as well be enjoying whatever we could now while the living was good. But I do think it ought to be part of our religion to live harmoniously, not only with each other, but with nature. And I think we're coming to it, in a sense, from economic necessity and aesthetic necessity. Sierra Club and people like that, saving the whales and preserving the environment. But most of that is still in the sense that we are the masters of the universe and everything's for our benefit, as we learned from Genesis. But the Indians didn't feel that way. They felt that they're part of it. And that, I've heard the Hopi say that the birds were here before we were, and therefore God loved the birds more than he loved us. So they're sort of privileged. And, I don't know that I endorse that entirely, but still I feel that we're part of the whole thing, and that we are animals, undoubtedly of a very superior kind because of our intellect or whatever, and that we have things thought out objectively and subjectively, rationally, not just by instinct. And maybe we're beginning to understand that the animals aren't so limited either, but I think we do need to feel that we're part of the thing rather than masters of it. And that may preserve us, may prevent us from destroying everything, and it may make a indefinite continuation of human life possible. But I think we have them to thank a great deal for more than we realize. I think there is a spirit in America that was not in Europe, that we did not inherit or bring with us from Europe, that we did acquire from Indians, and I think we owe them a debt of respect, at least. But a respect for diversity and freedom, and some more question to authority. We don't kowtow or kneel to the hierarchy the way I think is traditional in Europe. I think we learned something. I think we brought the message back to the world too. I don't think Europe is the way it used to be to the same extent for what it's been influenced by America. I think America's been very influential in the world. And I think that's in large measure to tribal people, not only American tribal people, but African tribal people too. Respect individuality, and respect freedom. Masters are only masters as long as they serve the public, instead of because they're born to it. And of course, aside from that, I've made some friends, and had a reason to apply myself to things that interested me, and felt that was rewarding. But I think the way Indians have made decisions has been certainly has been very congenial to Quakers. When George Fox came over, as I mentioned earlier, he found that the way Indians treated women, the way Indians made group decisions with the community, a committee of the whole, so to speak, everybody involved. And at least in some cases, of course, there's such a great diversity among Indians that you can't generalize in a way to say Indians are this or Indians are that. But I've seen a good deal of Indian decision making. And of course, some of them go by Robert's Rules of Order and taking it off from the Europeans. But there are some that I've seen, too, that have been much more native, I think. And I think there's been a characteristic for the little people to speak first. Everybody's there, and they make sure that everybody has something to say, or invite them to say it, you know, and nobody interrupts them when they're speaking. And it's only at the end that the heavyweights sort of summarize things. Whereas here we start out with the heavyweights who make their pitch, and then we vote on it. And we don't hear from everybody. I think that it takes a long time to do it their way. It may not be very efficient, but it's been rather congenial to friends, though. Friends have their business meeting in much the same way. I won't say that the heavyweights don't sway things, but still, in principle at least, the inside of the most humble person might be the best, and he ought to be heard.
It sounds like the Mohunk conferences. The Mr. Smiley speaking at the end,
okay.
Not at the beginning.
Okay, I've never been to one of them.
No,
but
just at the earlier ones. Or at least there's making a little introduction and letting everybody speaking and then coming to some consensus platform at the end in which he spoke.
Mm-hmm.
That was the question I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you, how does this relate to your Quaker friends' beliefs?
I don't know that the Mohawk conferences are the best example, although maybe they are more than I realize. And I've never attended one. I'm sorry I didn't attend the most recent one, but I was in bed sick, and I couldn't get up there. Thank you very, very much, and to James Smiley, too, for personal invitations to come. I would like to have been there. But what I've read of past, and I'm sure the times change, but they were very paternalistic in the early days, and it was quite some years before they had Indians giving the major addresses, the white people solving the Indians' problem for them. But it was very helpful, I don't doubt, too, and certainly in the context of their times, they certainly meant well. And it may be that Indians at that time didn't want to be speaking. Maybe they hadn't formulated the use of language or whatever to speak in our situation. They weren't interested in speaking to us about their problems.
But what was most interesting just now was your insights into the comparing Indian style of the parliamentary style.
I think there's been a respect for individuals among Indians and among Quakers. A central precept or belief among friends is that there's that of God in every man, or the inner light, or the Christ within, or whatever you want to call it, that respects each person. And not because of his birth or his title or his office or his dress or his degree of education or any of the other attributes that govern priorities and prestige in our society. But the truth may come to anybody and must be recognized, hopefully, and eventually, I guess, people come to recognize the truth. I think Indians have that feeling too, the respect for the individual, but blended with a rather interesting, I think, collectivism or communism, community, that is, the value of an individual is not his own wealth or whatever, but what he can do for the for his group. It may be a very small group, and they may not be much interested in the welfare of people they don't know, whether they be Indian or not Indian. So sometimes it seems as though they're very parochial. And other Indians may not have helped the Iroquois, the Senecas, the kind of things they were, and one thing like that. But they certainly are very loyal to their groups, their family to start with, their face-to-face communities, their local community, and more nowadays to the pan-Indian, the nationwide Native American problems.
How is the Indian people, although they are, there are certain rules, if you will, in terms of parliamentary rules, there's a lack of formality in certain areas. The formality is not as rigid as in our society. How does that correspond with the premise of your beliefs? Is it as rigid in terms of structure? Doesn't seem to be the formalized church structure some of the other churches.
Well, in some ways, I can see the comparison. In some other ways, I think that friends have a structure to their society that's formal, and people are very proper, a good deal of propriety. Kids don't run around and make a noise while friends are having their deliberations or their meetings for worship. Whereas I can remember in many other, particularly Indian communities, people come and go and kids move around and talk to each other. It seems sort of disruptive. I don't think that would go in Quaker circles.
Right, no, I don't think so.
But there's some similarities and some differences. I think friends have found Indians rather congenial in the way they treat each other, and they. I have a feeling that Indians were here for a long, long time with very small technological changes. And here I am, an engineer, and took pride in patents and new ideas and developments and new designs and creative thinking and all that sort of thing. I find Indians who are appalled by any change. They think if it isn't what your grandparents taught you, then it must be wrong. Well, that just seems so counter to the way I was been brought up. But I do think that if society is given a 10,000 years without some disruption, we might solve some of our problems. We might get to like the Russians or something or other, and they're telling. If we just took the time to it, if we don't blow each other up first. And I think the Indians had that opportunity with very little technological change. Now, when the Athabascan, Navajo, and Apaches moved in the southwest, they were disrupted. And they wanted some land, and it causes friction, and it's still there. I mean, they're different kinds of people. They're more aggressive than the Hopi or the Pueblos or some of their neighbors. But given a few more thousand years, that may change too. And I think internationally, we're making changes. We had a League of Nations, we had a United Nations, and we still have it. I don't know. We may have something different sometime in the future. But these are all steps of our evolution, I think. And if you don't change things too much, you may get to live with it. But I don't know, these nuclear weapons are just so hazardous and so final if they get used that I don't know if we'll have the millennia that we need to solve all our problems.
I don't want to ask just one other question on this without the
body, and all of us have busy minds and things that have happened to us all week. And the whole idea is to settle down, and the whole notion behind a friend's worship is to look within. Mm. And we have a faith that the divine God can be apprehended directly by each individual if we will but be patient and wait. And that's the reason we have our meeting largely on silence, on the basis of silence. An early friend in England, Isaac Pennington, said something which I think describes this very well. There is that within you that will guide you. Wait for it. And that's what we try to do.
I dare say that, of course, a lot of us do look within, but probably not long enough to find what we should find.
And including Quakers. I mean, how many minutes or hours do I spend in quiet worship during the week? And I have to confess that it's all too few.
You had mentioned the fact that we are a bit in the dark as to who the Quakers are. And I dare say, Jeanette, that the younger generation are too in the dark. Why so? Why is that?
Well, first of all, Quakers don't proselytize, so there's no real outreaching for people to join into the Quaker religion. Also, a lot of the work that we do, although we do a lot of things, we don't do it in the name of Quakerism. We don't say we're doing this as Quaker. A lot of it comes from an individual searching, and so individuals go out and do things. But anything else?
That more or less sums it up.
Let me continue with a couple of other points about our worship, which I think are important. As I said, we don't have a pulpit and we don't have an altar. So we don't even have a professional ordained minister to lead us.
Right.
And we don't have any sermon. We could have singing if anyone felt inclined to do so. But mostly it's an hour of quiet introspection, and the very plainness of the surroundings are an endeavor to keep people from being distracted with the outward and look within. Now, what happens in that hour? It could be that we'll have an entire hour of quiet and silent worship, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's sometimes a beautiful thing. More frequently than not, one or more persons, anybody in the room who feels a leading or an insight, a message, a prayer, or could even get up and give a hymn if they want. That's done sometimes. But we count on them to share with the group, and sometimes that will lead to others sharing. And so it's a case where, in a sense, we're all ministers.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something about our beliefs and something about our manner of worship.
Okay, generally, what are your present concerns, and what do you do about them?
Well, I'll turn to Jeanette for that for a moment.
Okay. The yearly meeting has a number of programs, Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, but also all the yearly meetings around the country have their own programs. But ours center around disarmament, education about peace. We have a nonviolence and children program. We have an anti-draft program, or a more education about militarism. We have a weekend work camps program where people go out and do work in the communities and learn about communities such as Mantua. We also have a program that tries to teach people peace within their own communities. It's called Friends Suburban Project, and it does community dispute settlement. So when there are disputes in a community, we try to get them to mediate their own settlement and come to a peaceful solution without having to go to the courts or to the police. Quakers also put a heavy emphasis on education, and although the yearly meeting has no programs, there are quite a few Quaker schools in the area, so a lot of outreach is done through that medium.
I dare say you are quite organized in all of these projects.
Yes. The way they're organized is all the programs at the yearly meeting, such as disarmament and the draft program and the weekend work camps are organized under testimonies and concerns. When people are led in meeting to express a concern, sometimes these concerns get turned into programs.
Right.
So they're all housed under testimonies and concerns, and they're fairly well organized.
Let me just comment a little further on this. We also, you see, work, Jeanette has been describing our sort of denominational as a, programs as a yearly meeting, but Quakers are hard to understand their organization. We have, for example, the American Friends Service Committee, whose national officers are in our office complex, which incidentally is at 15th and Ray Street.
Right.
That's our Friends Center, our office complex, whereas down at 4th and Arch is where it's already been said we have our large gatherings. Quakers generally, and certainly this is true of our yearly meeting as well as the American Friends Service Committee, I might just inject at this point, are very much concerned as to the drift in worldwide, but particularly in our country, toward arms buildup. And of course, the concomitant to that is the reduction in social programs that benefit the poor. But we're very, our yearly meeting has forwarded a minute, which I actually did it myself, delivered on behalf of our yearly meeting to the National Council of Churches, of which we're a member with headquarters in New York, urging that there be undertaken some kind of a massive response of religious and other concerned people against this drift toward the arms buildup and the awfulness of nuclear war.
So this is what you're doing about it. You are going right to the top.
Here is one instance where we are trying to be a catalyst as a very small body who is very much identified with concerns of peace to do what we can to try to mount public opinion to show where people feel, how people feel.
Right. As the years progress, of course, the concerns sort of multiply in the 1980s even more so than ever before. What do you see for the 1980s?
Well, our programs and the work that Quakers do are based on a couple of principles, and one is the Quakers are one of three peace churches. We have a peace testimony, and so that will always continue to be a concern of ours in the 80s, disarmament and peace in communities and racial peace and things like that. But we also have another of other concerns, racial concerns and simplicity. And
could I inject concerns for women?
Concerns for women.
You would be sensitive to that.
Right. So as we go into the 80s, we will carry these concerns that we've had in the past, but also maybe new ones will develop. But it's not, the 80s won't necessarily present, you know, a decade of we'll work on a certain concern. We continue to work on things that we've been working on in the past, and as new concerns come up, we'll pick them up also.
Have your actions gotten results?
Well, that's a question that's very hard to answer, but I think in the field of education, the Friends schools have contributed a lot to the whole field of education. I think you simply can't answer that.
Quakers are one of the first groups to work against slavery, and it started before the big abolitionist move in the United States. So we like to think that our people acted as a catalyst to that whole movement, and with disarmament or with some of the other issues, it may be the same.
I'm sure that that is what has happened and what is happening.
Yeah.
You know, this discussion shouldn't, we ought to mention a little more about William Penn. And I don't want to divert us here, but...
Well, we did mention William Penn, and of course, he was the start of the whole thing.
Well, as far as this country is concerned, but it seems to me that that is one of the most dramatic real-life episodes, where he had this opportunity, you know, to get this vast land in this new world because of the debt the king owed his father. And William Penn took this, and at that time, Quakers were being persecuted in England because they weren't part of the established church. But William Penn used this as a way to provide religious toleration, democratic precepts. His treatment of the Indians testifies to some of our Quaker beliefs, the things that we profess to be. We're human beings, and we don't always all live up to everything we profess. But there's a phrase that William Penn used, which I'd like to quote, and it takes us in as to why we get into these service projects. True godliness, he said, doesn't drive people out of the world, but enables them to live better in it. and excites their endeavors to mend it. And I think that's something that's still our rallying point.
Certainly so.
And yes, there'll be new concerns coming down the road, and I hope we can be vitality enough and be responsive enough to always be measuring these,
okay,
responding to these.
We just have a couple of minutes, and what I'd like to find out is, what do you see in the future for the Quakers? We mentioned the fact that Philadelphia is 300 years old. The Quakers are 301 years old.
We're entering our fourth century. We did have our tercentenary, but we don't make too much of special things like that. But Jeanette, do you have any insight on where we're going to go in the future?
Well,
in our fourth century?
I think there's a lot of hope for the future. Quakerism is not a very big sect. There's only 200,000 in the entire world, and in Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, there's around 14,000. But recently, at the Fourth and Arch Meeting House, we had a 2040s day where people between the ages of 20 and 40 got together, young Quakers. And we had over 200 people there, and that just never happens. But it was a good coming together. There was a lot of energy flowing out of that, and people in workshops. There were very good discussions. And I think that there's always this hope in the younger generation. And we'll just continue with the work that's been done in the past. But there does seem to be a real sense of energy there.
I'm glad to hear that, because the younger generation is who we look forward to.
Mm-hmm. Let me just say, before we run out of time, that we think that in spite of our small numbers, we feel there's real vitality. And I would just want to say to our listening audience that they're welcome to come to any Quaker meeting or anywhere and join in the worship on the Sunday morning or whenever. And that's the best way to find out. And if they feel led, well, we would certainly welcome them joining us. But I do want to extend that word of welcome.
Do you think that you will increase your membership in the years to come?
Oh, it's possible.
Sure, I think so.
Yeah.
You got to look forward with optimism.
It's funny, I went to a college that is not Quaker, and people didn't know very much about Quakers, but there was a lot of interest in it, and a number of my friends are now attending.
Oh.
So, you never know.
I hope through this program, and of course other programs like it, that more people find out
about
mm-hmm. the Quakers and the Friends. I want to thank you both for joining us this week and sort of initiating our tricentennial series. Next week, well, we're going to visit with the Baptists. And our journey happens to begin at the Lower Dublin Baptist Church, which was founded 298 years ago. Not quite as old, but almost.
Good enough.
And we certainly hope you'll join us, and you can join us too.
I'd love to. I'm good friends with the Baptists and all the groups you'll be interviewing. I work closely with them.
Thank you. Good morning.
Congressman, to make them understand that not only are there Indians in their district who vote, but there are also non-Indians who care about the honor of this country. An example of what can be accomplished, before last year when it was the subcommittee, they only passed three laws dealing with Indian affairs. Three for a whole session of Congress. And it's hard in the same way now in the House because they only have two people in all of the House working on national Indian legislation. In the committee, there are a lot of us, many of us Indian, who are working to get things done. And of the 57 laws that were referred to our committee, you know, a law first gets introduced by a senator, and then it's referred to the appropriate committee. We had 57 referred, and of those, we have voted out of our committee and voted out of the Senate, 22 of those. So that shows you some of the impact that you can have by putting a little more energy into Indian affairs. Now, most of those laws were small laws, you know, which were important to individual tribes, transferring 13 acres to a specific tribe. But of course, it was important to that tribe that got the benefit of it. Some of them were important for precedent value. For instance, the Sillette's bill was like the Menominees, who were terminated tribes. They were restored to their full status as an Indian tribe. These are out of Oregon, the Sillette's Indians. And so those kinds of bills are very good precedent, or a continuation of a good policy. Some of them, like the Community College Bill, will help many tribes. And some of them, like the Indian Child Welfare, which Kevin is getting Xeroxed off. And for those of you who are interested, you can pick up a copy of the report. I think the Indian Child Welfare Bill will be one of the major pieces of legislation to come out in a long time you know, the people in Geneva were using the term genocide when we talked about Indian people. And by that, they didn't mean shooting people down in the streets. But according to the UN definition of genocide, one of them is the sterilization of women of a certain culture. And another part of that UN definition, which the United States does not accept, by the way, and hasn't accepted, is taking children out of one culture and putting them in the dominant culture. Well, those are two things that have happened in the UN today. And there are two things that the Senate Committee has been very involved in, that Senator Abrez has been involved in. It was his GAO report that uncovered the sterilizations in the Indian hospitals. The other thing that is happening, which I'm sure the Indian people in the audience understand, is that a lot of children are not only being placed out into non-Indian homes for adoptions, but there's an incredible number of foster care places, because non-Indian social workers go in where they don't have proper jurisdiction even, and they go into a tribe and they impose their own value systems on, well, this family doesn't have enough bedrooms, therefore I'm going to take the children, which in most Indian cultures, certainly in the Comanche culture, children are very precious and very highly valued in the culture. And to take away your children is to destroy you as a people in a real sense. And that's why I think the Indian Child Welfare, which is now passed the Senate, and we're hoping to get it introduced next session in the House, is a major piece of legislation. What it deals with is set up federal standards on jurisdiction that a certain category of tribes will have jurisdiction over the domestic relationships of its children, and to also set standards in how foster placement for adoptions of Indian children will take place, to at least, at the very minimum, ensure that the parents and the tribe who that child is a citizen of has notice of what's going on. What's happened to its children. So I strongly urge an interest in that bill, because I think it's a major, major piece. Now, things that are going to be coming up for next year, those are things that we've done in the Senate this last year, and for the next year, we just have that one more year, and we're trying to get as much of what the Indian Policy Review Commission recommended done and actually enacted as possible. And one of the main things we're looking to is the code provision. For those of you who don't know about Indian law, Indians more than any other group in the country are legislated at. There are more laws, you know, it's left or hiding under. You can't turn around without being subject to some sort of federal law. There's a whole code in the United States, I mean, a whole volume in the United States code, a big, thick book, which is only laws dealing with Indian affairs. And that's Title 25 of the United States Code. And so one of the things that the commission set out, the Indian Policy Review Commission, which was a joint committee of Congress, set out to do, was to revise that, to codify the law. Because those laws, you know, were passed back when the Quakers were running Indian affairs, passed when the Army was running Indian affairs. The United States policy has vacillated, you know, up and down all over the road. And there's a real need to make a clear-cut policy, to get rid of those old archaic laws that are just encumbrances, to make it one policy that has a clear, and to do it in such a way that it's done with a consultation of Indian people. And so for 2 years, the commission worked on Task Force 9 and the codification of Title 25. And now that job has been taken over by the Senate committee. Pete Taylor is heading up that effort. He has three young Antioch lawyers working with him. And they've organized not only just the laws in the U.S. Code, but other laws, which also affect Indians, and the statutes at large. And they will decide what chapters, and try to organize it in a reasonable fashion. So if you wanted to look up something about water law, you could go and there would be a chapter on water law, because now it's just organized chronologically as it happened historically, which is real hard and difficult for Indian people then to find out what laws govern them. So that code revision will be organizing laws into chapters and repealing the bad laws, the old laws that don't make any sense anymore. And every chapter they do, they'll be sending out to Indian country, to tribes, to find out what the actual Indian people have to those, because they want to be sure that there's not some law which they think is archaic, which is really an important right to people. So if you as individuals have a real interest in reviewing this process, I'd be glad to get your name and address and take that back to them so you'll be in on the chapter revision, because that's going to be an ongoing thing. There should be hearings on it next June or July on the code revisions, and we're hoping to get an actual codification of the law through. Another important area that the committee's involved in are these eastern land claims, they're called non-intercourse land claims. That's where, way back, the Congress passed a law saying no Indian land transaction is valid unless Congress approves it. And that didn't really happen in the original 13 states, although, unfortunately, the western states got pretty much screwed by congressional approval. But it led to the eastern Indians a chance to claim those lands back, and our committee, because it has to be approved by Congress eventually, has been involved in that process. I'd like to let Alan Parker, who's going to be speaking later, speak more to that, because he's really been much more involved in the process personally than I have. Another major area that which may be a little more mundane to you than some of the stuff we've been talking about is the Self-Determination Act. The intent of that act was to transfer the control of federal programs from this giant, insensitive federal bureaucracy to the actual tribe itself, so that the tribe is actually servicing and taking care as a government the needs of its citizens. It was a great intent, a great concept, but it really hasn't been implemented properly. There hasn't been a real transfer of control, and that's because of the vested interest in the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service in keeping that power to themselves. So one of the things we're trying to do is to amend that Indian Self-Determination Act, and to avoid further problems, we're leaving what's there intact. That will not be changed. So that if a tribe wants to continue going through the contractual process, which is very burdensome in terms of paperwork and time and all sorts of other problems, the day-to-day kind of governmental problems, then a tribe can opt to do that. But we will provide, if this amendment is passed, which has been drafted, a third option where a tribe could sit down and tribal planners like Bob McLaughlin and others could for the first time have long-range plans. So you can talk about development of your timber or development of your natural resources in real terms, in real long-term management terms, up to 10 years. And would sit down and form a comprehensive plan of the types of programs and services that they want to see. And then that would be issued to them in the form of a consolidated grant, which we call a block grant, but one consolidated grant rather than having to go contract for education, contract for law enforcement, and contract for roads. You could just do it in one package, which would solve a lot of the procedural problems that tribes have run into. Another important part of that amendment is that for the first time it provides, tribes have complained that they've been in the straitjacket of the BIA, that even when they get the programs to run them themselves, they've been programmed to fail because they're just puppeting what the BIA has done. They have to take BIA budget, they have to take BIA programs, and they can't really set their own priorities and their own budget. And so one of the things this amendment would do is it would provide a bypass so that if tribes say, we need this much money, and the secretary says, well, I can only grant you this much because that's all we're using, he has to report that to Congress, and it can't get cut out by OMB. OMB is that Office of Management and Budget, and it's the one that cuts into a lot of Indian programs. Even when BIA says we want this much money, OMB will only allow them to ask Congress for a much lesser amount. This is required, a requirement by Congress that goes around that step, so that at least the appropriations committees will be able to see what Indians say are their true needs. So that's another thing, the amendment to the Self-Determination Act. And the final thing that I want to talk about is an issue that the committee has become more and more involved in, and that's the issue which was alluded to briefly earlier, of religious freedom. We're more and more becoming aware that a lot of the acts, which are good acts, I mean, the intent of them is good, to preserve the bald eagle. Well, no one more than Indians understands the necessity of doing that, or to preserve the bowhead whale. Indians understand the necessity of having bowhead whales around. It isn't the Indians who made those almost extinct, and yet it is. And so in most cases, Indians are very strongly supportive of the major intent of those laws. But because those laws were not meant to be religious laws, no one really considered the impact that they would have on religion. And because most non-Indians think of religion in their own terms, you know, what nice white church or the Bible or whatever terms they use, they don't really perceive Indian religions, because they are different than their religions, as being as valid as their religions. And yet they are. They are protected by the United States Congress, by the United States Constitution, by the state constitutions, and also by the Indian Civil Rights Act. There's no question that Indians have inherent right, even beyond, before the United States Constitution, to exercise their own religion. But because of an insensitivity and a lack of awareness on the part of the government, those religious rights are daily being abridged. And in very important ways, if you're going through customs, a customs officer is required to confiscate drugs. Well, peyote is classified as a drug, but it is clear that for religious purposes, as a sacrament, not as a hallucinogen, that drug can be possessed and kept by members who use it for religious purposes. Yet daily, we find that customs officials confiscate that when tribes or individuals have to go across the border for some important ceremony. Also, things that are not illegal, like juniper berries, juniper leaves, like sweetgrass, things which are not illegal but customs think might be illegal, get confiscated. Medicine bags get opened when they shouldn't even be touched. All sorts of things that are happening that are horrifying to the, that are real violating of an individual's religion. And so because of this, throughout the country, the Senate committee has gotten involved in the problem. They set themselves out as a forum to bring together executive agencies, the Fish and Wildlife Services, the Customs Bureau, Drug Enforcement, to try and bring them together and make them aware that there is a problem, that they have to look to their own regulations, which sometimes are much more restrictive than actual laws, and to sensitize the people who are doing the enforcement that Indians are in a different situation and have to have their religious freedom protected. As well as doing that, we are also, the reason that we found the executive group is because a lot of what could be done in terms of changing these violations could be done at an executive level. And the best way would be to start with a presidential statement or directive, an executive order, saying, Indians have the right of religious. We are reaffirming that, and we shall dedicate federal policy to be sensitive of that in all the various areas of our federal law and enforcement. So if you want to petition the president to do that, that helps. Every little letter to get him aware of the situation is going to be necessary. We're also trying to set up an interagency, because these problems cut across departmental lines, to set up an interagency task force to consult. For instance, on that bowhead whale situation, they never asked Eskimos what effect it would have on the cultural disintegration of their people. They never asked Eskimos how it related to their religion. They were just ignored. And the reason they were ignored is because of the vast ignorance of the State Department, really. I mean, they just had no awareness of what was going on. And so at least this interdepartmental task force would set up a consultation process. As well as doing that, we're talking about a joint resolution of Congress setting forth as a federal policy that this is also Congress's intent, that the right to religious practice and religious freedom and the pursuit of one's culture, which is an integral part of that religious freedom, is essential to the American Indians, and that Congress agrees with that goal. And we've so far gotten commitments from Senator Humphrey, Senator Kennedy, and Congressman Udall to support that effort, and we're just beginning to generate support. So we're hoping that in the next year we'll be able to do something positively on that issue. So now I want to open it up for questions if you have any, if you don't want to rush off the... Yeah.
Catherine, we were told in your explanation that OMB was opposed to the child welfare.
That's right.